We're doing it for them.
Yes, definitely.
For sure.
All right. Well, if that's the case, then let's start from the beginning. We'll do the beginning sort of overview style review. I'm sure as we go through it, it'll jog memory, whether recent memory or distant memory. Or
we do this with Vardy.
Yes, we do.
See, it jogged memory already, and I haven't even started.
About 10 years ago?
No. Kefsi was like 10 when we started. You and I started.
It was a while ago. But I suspect, given that that it was a long time ago, and B, that different teachers teach material differently, and so it is quite possible that what you learned will take a different angle than how we will go through it. But additional perspectives are always welcome. So you know, we'll have that opportunity to share. All right, let's go back. Let's start from the beginning. Then we read through the first chapter and the beginning of the second chapter. That was sort of where we had, and we left off with a lot of questions, not a lot of answers, because we sort of left in the middle. So we're just gonna start from the beginning and review the questions, and that way we'll have a common basis from which to begin to explore. So I'm going to read from the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, which in the Hebrew English is on page
325.
Okay. At least in the Koran Hebrew English. The other ones, the Art Scroll and the JPS, whatever you have. Vayhi ish echad min ha-ramatayim tzofim mehar Ephraim. ושמו אלקנה בן ירחם בן אליהו בן תוכו בן צוף אפרתי. So this, we just read this as the Haftorah. It's a Haftorah of birth of Shmuel is the Haftorah of almost
Rosh Hashanah.
Right. Correct. One of the days of Rosh Hashanah, first day of Rosh Hashanah. So there was a man from Ramatayim Tzofim. We talked a little bit about the name Ramatayim Tzofim. It's an interesting phrase. It's almost a tautology. Ramah is a hill, high place. Ramatayim, double hill, double high place, some sort of a double peak. Tzofim, tzofer.
It's a scout.
It's a scout, to look out, to see. Also named for a place of a high. Har Ephraim. The mountainage of Ephraim, all the cities and the names of the area of Ephraim, the cities were always built on the tops of the mountains or the tops of the hills for many reasons, including what is today very common in Israel, in the area of new settlements. They typically are located on the tops of hills or mountains, very rarely are in the valley, and that's a very simple reason, and they're often given names related to Mitzpeh, Tzofim, Ramah, similar type of names both in times of Tanakh and today. This particular person, Elkanah ben Yerucham ben Elihu ben Tocho ben Tzuf Ephrati, we happen to know that he is also from Shevet Levi, which we went to the Yuchas back when, which means that how do you be in a Levi and an Ephrati? What does Ephrati mean? Ephrati doesn't mean from the city of Ephrat, because the city of Ephrat is south of Yerushalayim, and Har Ephraim is north of Yerushalayim. Ephrati means? Say it louder.
Ephraim.
From Ephraim, correct. From Ephraim, Ephrati, but he's not from Shevet Ephraim, he's from the area of Ephraim, he's a Levi. Not the first time we encountered a Levi from Har Ephraim.
Right, the guy with the bed and breakfast.
The guy with the bread and breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Back in Sefer Yoshoft. V'lo shtei nashim, shem achat chana, v'shem ashenit pnina, v'yu lefnina yiladim ulechana en yiladim. Two wives, one has children, one is not. Also an uncommon story in Tanakh. We talked about the parallel to Yaakov, Rachel and Leah, or Avraham, Sarah and Hagar. What is two wives, sometimes for reasons where one doesn't have children, they take a second wife. But in this case, he had two wives, Rachel and Leah being the more common parallel. Pnina had children, Chana did not. Every year he would come, make the pilgrimage to bring offerings in Shiloh. And there in Shiloh were the two sons of Eli, Chofni and Pinchas. Chofni and Pinchas will become very important for us in chapter 2. This is the Navi begins to describe Chofni and Pinchas. At the beginning of chapter 2, we are told, or in the middle of chapter 2, that the Vnevli Eli Bnei Belial lo yadu et Hashem. That these two sons of Eli, Bnei Belial,
they were in there for the money.
They were in there for the money. They were not particularly altruistic and well behaved. Lo yadu et Hashem. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But part of that message, which we also talked about, was the midrashic and approach or insight, which appears in many of the Mefarshim as well, that this reference to Eli to Elkanah making his annual pilgrimage to the Beit Hamikdash was not something that was commonplace. It was in fact very uncommon. It was very out of the ordinary or extraordinary. Part of the reason it was extraordinary was precisely because, as the Mefarshim point out, this pasuk is suggesting that the fact that Elkanah made his annual pilgrimage to the Mishkan in Shiloh was not because Eli's sons Chofni and Pinchas were there, but not because Elkanah's visit to the Mishkan was not because of Shnei Bnei, two sons of Eli, but despite the two sons of Eli. In other words, the understanding of this verse is that Elkanah made his pilgrimage every year to Shiloh, even though Sham Shnei Bnei Eli Chofni Ufinchas Kodim Lashem, even though the Mishkan was at that time run by two people who are described as worthless people, Lo Yaduot Hashem, Chofni Ufinchas, and that gives way to or opens up the door to a host of midrashic interpretations on the first verse, that he would come from Haratzofim, Elkanah would come every year to the Mishkan. Every year he would take, or every verse that he would take a different road in order to encourage more people to come. It's this, the sense that the Mishkan is not a happy place. It's not a place that people are flocking to in droves. Anachronistically, and I say that because the time frames don't work out, but anachronistically, Chazal compare, and we did this in Sefer Shoftim, compare the neglect of the Mishkan in the opening verses of Sefer Shmuel to the embrace of the bed and breakfast of Micha in the end of Sefer Shoftim. To which the Gemara says the reason why they were flocking to the bed and breakfast of Micha was because Pitom Mitzuya etzel Orachim or etzel Ovred Dvachim, that he would give food, give bread, give lodging and quarter to the people who were traveling through. That's why he opened up this whole operation where people would come and stay, and it was hospitable. Whereas in the Mishkan of Chofni and Pinchas time frame, they are anything but hospitable. So even though the two time frames don't match, even at the end of Sefer Shoftim, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, but that story of Chofni and of Pesach Micha is a much earlier story, for all kinds of reasons which we talked about in Sefer Shoftim. But Chazal linked the two for the obvious reason that there's a conceptual framework here. In Sefer Shoftim, for 350 years, we barely hear about the Mishkan. Sefer Shmuel opens up with the story of Chana, Chofni, Pinchas, Eli. By the time we get to chapter 4, the Mishkan is destroyed. That's not an accident. That comes on some background, and that essentially is what Chazal were trying to identify. Okay, that's the summary of the first three verses. That, if you remember, was our first shiur back in back in Manju. So, unit number one. Unit number two. Vayihi hayom. Vayizbach el kana. Venatan lifnina ishto. Ulechol vanea uvnata manot. And this was a routine. They would come. Elkanah would bring sacrifices. He would give to Pnina, his wife, and to her sons portions. Ulechana yiten mana achat apayim. To Chana, he would give mana achat apayim, meaning one more, double portion. Ki et Chana ahev v'Hashem sagar rachma. He loved Chana, and God had closed her womb. Again, we talked a little bit about the parallel to the story of Rachel and Leah, where Yaakov loved Rachel, and God had closed her womb. The notion of love and what the Torah describes as sina, or love and hate, or contrast in with regards to wives, which is not an uncommon phrase for the Torah to use, needs some explanation. I don't know if we discussed this back in the spring. But very often the Torah will describe the relationship between a husband and two wives as one whom he loves and one whom he hates, right? Which is a very strange phraseology for the Torah to use. The Torah rarely discusses emotional relationships. First of all, it's a very strong emotion, and second of all, the Torah rarely uses emotional descriptions of any kind for human beings. The exception of an emotional relationship with God, after Hashem Elokecha, etc., there's very rarely does the Torah identify emotional behavior. Avram at the Akedah, the Torah is silent about his emotional turmoil because it's not part of the genre of the Torah. It just doesn't go there usually. The only exception is with regards to love and hate as it applies to husband and wife, and almost always in the context of having two wives. So, for example, if you look at Parshat Ki Tetzeh, probably the most famous such description. Which you will find in Sefer Dvarim, Perek Chaf Aleph. Somebody will find it in
236.
Find your page. 236. Okay. Pasuk Chaf Aleph. No, sorry, Pasuk Tetvav.
236.
And this is sort of the classic example of the Torah's in the context of a mitzvah. Ki tiena le'ish shtei nashim, man has two wives, ha'achat ahuva ve'ha'achat snu'a, one loved, one despised. Ve'yaldu levanim ha'ahuva ve'ha'snu'a, they'll both have children. Ve'ya ben ha'bechol ha'snu'a, and as it will happen, the firstborn will be from the hated one. והיה ביום הנחילו את בניו את אשר יהיה לו, לא יוכל לבקר את בן האהובה על פני בן הסנועה הבוחר. Cannot give preference to the son of the loved one instead of the one who is the firstborn of the hated. The firstborn is the firstborn. He is legally the heir to that double portion. And the father doesn't have the right to say he's going to choose the son on the basis of which of his wives he prefers, ki et habachor ben hasnu'a yakir latet lo pishnaim. He has to give that double portion to the ben hasnu'a. So again, you have this emotional description of the relationship between a husband and his two wives, which is a very strange context, and between the description of Yaakov and Rachel and Leah and Elkanah, Chana and Pnina, you have this reference several times. One of the suggestions that I heard, which I think actually makes a lot of sense, is that although we use the term ahava and snu'a and sin'a in very emotional contexts, in the context of the Torah's description of a husband with multiple wives, especially in the context of dealing with inheritance, heir, leadership, etc., typically, in a polygamous society, one wife was always considered the primary wife, and the other was always considered the secondary wife. Primary wife, either because that was the first one, or the one who was married to give to have children, or in a context of a monarchy, which was very common, where you had a harem of wives or multiple wives for political reasons, was always one who was chosen to be the mother of the heir to the throne, right? The chosen wife. Typically, the Torah will use the term ahuva to reflect a function of choice, not an emotional relationship.
But sinah is strong.
Because it's the opposite of ahuva. In other words, it's terminology that we attribute with great emotional gesture and depth. I'm not sure the Torah means it in an emotional context as much as it meant it as a function of a reflection of which one in the mindset of the husband was the primary wife and which is the secondary wife. And therefore the primary wife would be described as the one who in the husband's mind was the ahuva, and the secondary wife would have been described as not ahuva. So the term for not ahuva would be snua. But even though we attribute emotional value to that statement, the terminology in the Torah may actually be a function of chosen and not chosen more than loved and not loved.
Do you think choice of words maybe is an indication subsequentio that the a disfavor of polygamy?
There is no question that the Torah discouraged it. Disfavored it, as you put it. There's no question to that effect. And if you look at the story of the Avot, when you consider the fact that the polygamous relationships that are described by the Avot are all functions of circumstances, not choice. Abraham has one wife until she has no children, and then by her choice, he takes on Hagar. Yitzchak has one wife. There is no polygamy. Yaakov also had one choice, one chosen. And if it was up to him, he would have only ever had one wife. And therefore, she's described as the one whom he loves until the end of his life. Considered her, Metalai Rachel, that his wife, his primary wife was always Rachel. Even Leah was considered secondary to Rachel, and certainly the Shvachot were considered secondary. In terms of the heir, in terms of the choice of Yosef, was part of that hierarchical structure. And in the context of a melech, it was expected, it was mandated. A melech had to have one wife who was chosen to be the mother of the heir to the throne. That was the whole story of David and the relationship with Bathsheba. It was because he promised her that she would be the mother of the heir to the throne, despite all the challenges related to the relationship that with her and the opposition that he had to that choice. Eventually, that was the conflict over the kingdom and the choice of Shlomo Melech as the heir to his throne. So it was a very common theme in the context of polygamy. In Chumash, post-Yaakov, we don't have any indication of polygamous relationships, certainly not by Moshe, certainly not by the Shvatim. And then you'll see it again here, and again in a context where it's full of turmoil and usually related to children and the issue of fertility. In rare instances, you have it outside of that context, and it usually doesn't bode well. For example, Yiftach, right, who is the son of another woman, or a woman from a second wife, or whatever way you want to describe it, in the polygamous relationship, and Yiftach's story doesn't start well. So there's no question that there's a disfavor to it, but I think that the terminology ahava and bechira are interconnected. The notion of a wife who's chosen, or the wife who's the primary, or the wife who's the mother of the heir, and that's what the Torah was addressing over there. In the context of a firstborn, if the firstborn is a biological firstborn, the husband doesn't have the right to arbitrarily choosing who the firstborn should be. In the context of a king, the king does, but in the context of inheritance generally, we do not.
Can I make a comment based on that?
Mm-hmm.
Yosef was not the firstborn.
He's the firstborn of Rachel, correct.
But
correct.
But he's still the first. You're saying that the firstborn of Leah should
should have been the firstborn, and by right should have, in Yaakov's blessings to his children, it's clear that he had every intention of making Reuven his firstborn
until Reuven
sinned. In the context of his violation of Bilhah, Reuven lost that right. And that's recorded both in the blessings of Yaakov to his children, that Reuven's right to this firstborn was lost in the context of the behavior with Bilhah. Shimon and Levi don't fit into that context either because of the story of Shechem. Yehuda gets a portion of that concept of the firstborn as it applies to leadership. And Yosef gets it in the context of the double portion of the tribe that gets split into Ephraim and Manasseh. And then it's repeated in Divrei Hayamim, where the pasuk states explicitly that Reuven was Yaakov's firstborn, and he lost that double portion of the firstborn because of his behavior with Bilhah, and it was given over to Yosef, who's the firstborn of the next wife. So you are correct that Reuven should have been. But in the context of Chumash, you know, it's interesting. In the context of Sefer Bereishit, there's a separate theme going on. And that is that what we attribute to the right of the firstborn, which is the double portion. In the context of, let's call it a pre-Matan Torah arena, or Sefer Bereishit, the right of the firstborn is much more is much broader than the double portion. It's the right of leadership, it's the heir to the position of the patriarch of the family. Part of the reason there was a double portion given to the firstborn, part of the explanation was that the firstborn was responsible financially for the family, and therefore there was a greater inheritance given to the firstborn because of that financial responsibility. It's a whole dynamic to it. But what's interesting about Sefer Bereishit is that no firstborn ever manages to keep that role of leadership. Every firstborn loses it, just by rights of circumstances. From Cain and Hevel to Yishmael over Yitzchak, to Esav over Yaakov, to Reuven over Yosef. Right. There's this thread that runs through, a theme that runs through Sefer Bereishit, of the notion that ultimately you have to deserve it. And when it comes to leadership roles, you have to deserve it. Double portion is a separate issue. The Torah addressed the double portion issue. But as far as leadership roles, what was expected or standard concept of deserve of automatic right to succession comes along the Torah and Sefer Bereishit and argues very clearly that you have to deserve it by behavior. It's an interesting theme that runs through Sefer Bereishit. But the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim states explicitly, "B'nei Reuven b'chor Yisrael, Reuven, firstborn of Yaakov, ki hu abachor, he was the firstborn, uvechalelo yitzue aviv, when he violated his father's couch, nitna b'chorato livnei Yosef ben Yisrael. That firstborn right of double portion was taken from him and given to Yosef v'lo li'tyaches la'b'chora. And the firstborn succession was therefore given to Yosef and not to Reuven. Ki Yehuda gavar be'achav. Yehuda was considered the gavar be'achav, the one who was the leader above his brothers. Ulenagid mimenu. And the leader over them, v'habuchara liYosef, but the firstborn to Yosef. So that description is actually articulated very, what is alluded to in Sefer Bereishit is expressed explicitly at the beginning of Perek He in Divrei Hayamim. That's just an observation. Okay, so that was a sidebar as far as Ahava and Sina goes. Certainly in Chana Pnina's case, you see that as well. Chana is his, let's call it the primary wife, or the wife of choice, but has no children. Pnina, and what was not uncommon was a situation where somebody would not have children, and the husband would take a second wife in order to be able to have children. And then subsequently, the first wife, who was barren, after there are other children in the house, would have her own children. And that is not an uncommon phenomenon even till today. Stories of mothers who adopt families who adopt children and then have children of their own. Okay, this was a biblical version of that same phenomenon, where you bring children into the household and suddenly the first wife is able to conceive. Back to Pasuk Vav.
I have a question. Is the second wife considered a surrogate kind of situation? I mean, what are the rights of those children?
Only in the context of Abraham and Sarah was there this notion because that was a unique relationship defined specifically with a maidservant that had a pre-biblical, pre-Matan Torah context, wouldn't apply beyond that. It's just two wives, children of the first wife, children of the second wife. Then they can fight over the inheritance, which is typically what happened. V'chi asata tzarata gam ka'as ba'avur har'ima. That's a difficult verse grammatically, but a couple of observations. First of all, the word tzara. The word tzara is the Torah's term for
leprosy.
No, tzara'at is leprosy. Okay. Right? Tzara is the, anytime you had two wives, that description of the relationship between the two wives was that each one was the other's tzara, which comes from the word tzarot, or trouble, or competition. Right, they were the competition. And it's tzaras, exactly. It's the same root as the word tzaras. So which goes back to your comment about the attitudinal approach that that Tanakh always took to polygamy. But that is, in fact, the Torah's term for competitive wives, and the term that's stuck in the language of the Mishnah and the Gemara as well. So this, the tzarata, her tzara, meaning Chana's tzara, would be Pnina. Chi asata gam kas. She would anger her, she would provoke her, she would make fun of her, she would ba'avur had ima, because her womb was closed, because she was kisagar shem ba'ad rachma. So Nebach, Chana's trouble, is not only the fact that she doesn't have children, not only the fact that this is emphasized to her every time they come to the Beit HaMikdash on the regular pilgrimage, and suddenly Chana, Pnina, and all of her children would get their portions, and Chana Nebach would get a double portion, as if she was the Bechor, but nonetheless she has no children. On top of all of that, she had Pnina to deal with. That little episode, verses 5 and 6, Chen Ya'aseh Shana B'Shana. This is, right, every year. This would take this little snapshot of what would go on, and this would take place every single year. Midei Alota B'Vet Hashem, Ken Tach Isena. Every time they'd go up to the Beit HaMikdash, Pnina would get her angry, would provoke her, she would be reminded of the fact that she is barren, and she would be frustrated. Tativke V'lo Tochal. Cry, she wouldn't eat. Vayomer la Elkanah Isha. Elkanah, her husband. Do you have a question?
No.
Oh, sorry. It's like when they run the appeal in shul and they tell everybody to sit on their hands, you know. Vayomer la Elkanah Isha. Chana, lama tifki? Velama lo tochli? Velama yera levavech? Why are you crying? Why are you not eating? Why are you bitter? Halo anochi tov lach me'asera banim. Am I not better for you, or as good for you as 10 children? Which is probably definitely the wrong thing to say to her. So there's a whole discussion in the Mefarshim as to whether or not he was trying to provoke her, whether or not he was, on the contrary, trying to
feel better. I don't see
how. Misjudged.
It didn't work. Right? I don't see how.
But in the meantime, certainly did not work. There's some discussion about a conflict brewing between Chana and Elkanah over this statement that the tension is growing. On all fronts, the tension is growing. And that sets the stage for the one fateful year where Chana finally decides to do something, change the equation. And the best of this parak is what she does to change the equation. V'atakom Chana acharei ochla b'shilo v'acharei shato ve'eli ha-kohen yoshev al ha-kiseh al-muzazat echal Hashem. Eli, a Kohen, is sitting on his throne, if you will. Eli is the Kohen Gadol. Yosef al Kiseh, interesting description. Kohen Gadol suddenly has a chair, he has a throne. There is no description anywhere in Chumash to a throne for the Kohen Gadol. But it is true that the Kohen Gadol, in relationship to the other Kohanim, was a Melech. The domain of the Kohen Gadol in relationship to the other Kohanim was a Melech. In what way? How do we know that?
You assign it to the various sacrifices and things to the other Kohanim.
So Gadol Me'achav, he certainly is described as elevated amongst his brothers, and he has a role, a responsibility role. But there's a graphic image relationship that is clearly one of Melech and Eved in relationship between the Kohen Gadol and the other Kohen. You see it just in the garments. You see it in the daily routine of the garments. Every Kohen is dressed in white. The Kohen Gadol is dressed in
gold,
and there's very little gold actually in the garments. The gold is specifically to a gold crown. The tzitz that he wore on his forehead, Kodesh LaHashem, is a crown. So you've got a Kohen Gadol wearing a crown, everybody else wearing a hat. You've got garments made of...
It has gold thread,
but the gold actually is less the significance in the garment, or the coloring of the garments, even though it's called Bigdei Zahav. It's called Bigdei Zahav in the context of Yom Kippur, but really, if you look at the coloring of the garments of the Kohen Gadol, they were very colorful. But in particular, they were colored with blue and purple. Tchelet v'argaman. The Talat Shani, a little bit of red. And Tchelet and Argaman were typically colors of royalty. That's why the color Tchelet is referred to in English as royal blue. Because it was typically the color of royalty.
That's cool.
When Mordechai in Megillat Esther... When Mordechai, at the end of the story, after the roles are reversed, and after he emerges to replace Haman in his role, and the fall of Haman, right? The pasuk says, "When Mordechai yatzam lifnei Melech b'levush techelet b'levush malchut techelet v'chur." He wore royal garments, techelet v'chur. So the royalty of the garments is in the color. The royalty of the garments is in the color. Tchelet, Agaman, these are colors partially because they were very expensive. You know the story of how Tchelet was made?
It was from a snail.
So there was the modern Tchelet is made in the same way. It's from a snail. Modern Tchelet is also very expensive, by the way, relative to. But in biblical times, it was even more so, dramatically more so. And the average rank-and-file citizen could not afford garments of tchelet, let alone a thread of tchelet, let alone garments of tchelet. That's exactly why the Torah commands tzitzis. We're digressing, but already it's just power of association. Right? Why the Torah commands a thread of tchelet and tzitzis. Because it's, in a sense, a uniform of the Jewish people who are mamlechet Kohanim v'goy kadosh. So it's the garment of royalty, not a garment. Kohen Gadol wore a garment of tchelet. Melech wore a garment of tchelet. We, by virtue of the kedusha and the role of mamlechet kohanim, wore one thread of tchelet. But the concept, and it's, it was the same. See if we can find the pasuk. Umordechai yatzam lifnei Melech b'levush malchut Tchelet v'chur v'ateret zahav gdola v'tachli chvutz v'argaman. So what are royal garments? We don't know what all of these things are, but there's enough to hear, right? Tchelet, zahav, and argaman. That's royal garments, by virtue of their color. And so, how did we get into this?
Kisei.
Right, so the Torah never describes the Torah describes the Kohen Gadol as a melech amongst the Kohanim. That's clear. He wears a tzitz. He wears garments of tchelet, but not a melech amongst the people. Right? He's a servant. He's an eved. He's an oved Hashem to the people. He's not a melech. Right? The people have a political king, and the domains of the melech and the domains of the Kohen Gadol are separate. One of the major issues in Sefer Shmuel later on, and in Sefer Melachim especially, is the division of the domain of the Melech and the political Melech and the Kohen Gadol. One king in biblical history violated that domain and walks into the Beit HaMikdash to offer Ketoret on the Mizbeach as the Kohen Gadol. His name is Uzziah, and the result was an earthquake that shook the foundations of Har HaBayit and almost destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. The result was also that Uzziah himself was smitten with Tzarat, and it was the end of the story of Uzziah. That domain was never to be crossed. But there was never a description till now of the Kohen Gadol sitting on a throne.
But does Kisei here definitely mean throne? Could it just be a chair?
Or just a place?
Yeah. I mean, does it have to be a throne?
Place.
Yoshev al hakise al mezuzat echal Hashem. It's right. Al hakise, the chair, and the entrance to the hechal. He's sitting there watching people come and go. We'll see as Hannah enters, Eli sees her enter from his chair. Right. Later on in Perek Dalid, after the Aaron is taken captive by the Plishtim, says in a minute. Perek Dalid Pasuk Yud Chet. Or start Pasuk Yud Gimel. This is the end of the war that with the Plishtim, when the Aaron was taken by Chofne Pinchas from the Mishkan into the battlefield. And then lost. And then it was captured by the Plishtim. So a remnant, a survivor of the battle, comes to inform the king. Vayavo, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayavo, Vine, Eli Yoshev al Hakise. Again, Eli is sitting on the chair or throne. Yad Derech Mitzapeh, by the way, waiting. He was concerned, he was frightened, he was worried about the Aaron. The person came to report about what was going on. Eli heard this great cry, and he said, what is all this about? He came and reported to Eli. So here's, think about the image for a second. Eli is sitting on a chair. And here's the turmoil, the tumult in the town or in the Mishkan, that the survivor had come to report about the war. He's worried about the war, so he says, "Let him come in." So he's sitting on the chair, and this informant comes to tell him what's going on. This isn't just you get the sense that it's not just a chair, but it's a significant chair. Right? Eli is sitting there, and the person comes to him. Like an audience, right? The Mevaser, this person who's bringing the information about the battlefield, tells him about the war, the failure of the war, and ultimately that the Aaron is taken captive, is captured. Perek Pasuk Yud Chet, Vayhi Kazkiro et Aaron Elokim. When he mentioned that the Aaron was taken by the Plishtim, Vayipol Me'ala Kisei Achoranit. He was shocked, and he fell backwards off the chair. Ba'ad yad hashav, v'tishaver mafrakto v'yamot. And his neck broke, cracked, and he died. Kizaken ha'ish v'chaved. He was old and he was very heavy. So when he fell heavily. That's how Eli dies. So he dies by falling off this chair. There's this constant description of this chair. I think it's more than a chair. When you talk about the Kohen Gadol sitting al hakisei, Yoshev Petach Ha'oel, sitting at the entrance of this of the Mishkan, this is this sounds like a throne. If a regular hedyot was, besides the fact that you were the only person who was allowed to sit in the Beis HaMikdash was the Melech. It's halacha that ein yeshiva bevet hamikdash ela lemalchut lemalchei beit David. You had to be a melech to have the right to sit in the Beis HaMikdash.
He's not going
to
sit in a regular chair.
Right? This is the Kohen Gadol sitting on a chair. This is not a green chair or even a red chair. This is a this was a throne. Not even a white chair. This is a throne.
Not even a white chair.
This is a throne. All right. Back to Pasuk Tet. V'atakom chana achrei ochla b'shilo v'achrei shetov Eli ha-kohen yoshev al ha-kisei ha-muzizat techal Hashem. V'hi marat nafesh. She is bitter. V'atitpalel al Hashem u'vachot tivkeh. She cried. She prayed. She poured out her heart in her tefillah. Hence the reason why, part of the reason why this is read as the Haftarah on Rosh Hashanah. Because there's a Masoret that she was answered on Rosh Hashanah, but also because the whole paradigm of tefillah comes from Chana, and the notion that tefillah is a sense of a pouring out of one's soul before God, which is central to the theme of Rosh Hashanah, also comes from Chana. V'atido neder, v'tama, Hashem tzvakot. She takes an oath, and we'll come back to this oath after we finish all the issues related to Chofni Pinchas, etc. We're going to come back to trying to understand this, what she wanted to accomplish in this oath. But she takes an oath, and she says, God of hosts, if you see the affliction of your maidservant, remember me, do not forget your maidservant. Another connection to Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaZikaron. V'netata la'amatcha zera anashim, give your maidservant seed, children. U'netativ la'ashem ko yemei chayav, I will give him to God all the days of his life. You give me a child, what's the expression? Right back at you. I will give him back to you. Which comes back to the whole question of, so what was she trying to accomplish? She's going to give him back to God, whatever that means. And we dedicate him to the temple, we'll see, to bring him as an apprentice. She's going to essentially relinquish, virtually, let him grow up under Eli's tutelage. This child's going to grow up in the Beit HaMikdash, if that's what she meant or not, I'm not sure. But, so what's the point of having a child if you're not going to raise him, if you're not going to have him in the house, if it's not going to be essentially your child? She's trying to get back at Pnina and show to Pnina just that she can do it too?
She wasn't complaining if
you
wanted the child to be the king.
To be the king? You mean to be the Kohen Gadol? He's a Levi. It would be hard. Maybe. It would be hard. But it's possible. Umara lo yale avosho. And in addition to everything else, I'll give him back to you, and Mara lo yale avosho, a razor will not come upon his head.
Oh, sounds like Shlomo.
Shlomo wasn't a Nazir.
You mean
Shimshon?
No.
Shimshon. Right. That's exactly what it sounds like. Shimshon, except that in Shimshon, right?
Close, but no cigar.
Right. In Shimshon's case, which is also a Nazir from birth, right? But in Shimshon's case, that oath didn't come from Eshem Manoach. That oath came from
Hashem.
Right, from Hashem through the Malach. It was imposed on her. This is voluntary. V'haya ki hirbata litpalel lifnei Hashem, and that was her tefillah. And this was all, of course, quietly. Nobody else knows what she said. Ki yibeta litpalel lifnei Hashem ve'eli shomer et pia. Eli is watching. Eli is watching her mouth. Why is Eli watching her mouth?
They think she's drunk.
Right. Ve'chana ini medaberet al liba rak sfatei na'ot ve'kola lo yishamer. He can't hear her voice. She's moving her lips. She's speaking from the heart, which evidently was unprecedented in the format of tefillah. Vayachsheve Eli l'shikora. And he thought she was drunk. I shared with you, I think, at the time last year, the Vort of the Vilna Gaon, that how did Eli make the mistake of thinking that she was Shikora? Because the Gra says that the way the Kohen Gadol would assess the questions posed to the Urim V'Tumim, to the breastplate, to the Chosh Mishpat, was by having certain letters lighting up. And the letters lit up in the word Shikora, but you had to rearrange the letters like a code, and if you rearrange the letters spelled kshera. Mm-hmm. But he misread them as shikora. Part of the Gros attempt to answer the question, how could he be the Kohen Gadol who has access to the Urim V'Tumim and the Chosh Mishpat and make such a dramatic error into thinking that she was drunk? So he suggested that he misread the Urim V'Tumim. Vayomer ele Eli. Ad matay tishtakanin? Asiri et yenech me'alaych. My dear woman, this is not a place for people who drink. Come back when you're sober. V'tan chana v'tomer lo adoni ishak shatruach anochi. No, my master, I am not drunk, I am bitter. Yayin v'shechalu shatiti v'shpoch et nafshi lifnei Hashem. I have not drunk wine, I have simply poured out my soul to God. Al titenet amatcha lifnei bat Belial. Do not make your maidservant to be a worthless woman. Did we talk about this phrase last time? No. Okay. Good. Al titenet. It's okay. Al titenet amatcha lifnei bat Belial. Do not portray your maidservant as a worthless woman. I had much to say and I had much bitterness to express. In other words, she says to him, this is not about drinking, this is not about, I spoke, but it's speaking in prayer. And here Eli says something remarkable. With all the criticism of Eli, what he says here is really remarkable. Vayomer Eli, Vayomer Lechi L'Shalom. Go in peace. Ve'elokei Yisrael yitenet shelatech asher sha'alt me'imo. May God answer your prayer, your request that you made from him. Now listen to the language of the Navi. In other words, there's not only a comment of Eli's acknowledgement that he's erred with regards to who she is and what she is, but even the phraseology, what did Chana say? What was Chana's request?
You give me a child,
and I'll give him back to you.
Wow, that's
the Tativ LaHashem Kol Yemei Chayav.
Right?
Yeah.
What is Shaul? What does Eli say to her, go in peace, and she'elatech asher sha'alt me'imo. She'elatech asher sha'alt means
the questions which you made.
The request which you requested. Lish'ol is to request. It's supposed to be to ask, but it really comes from the word to request. She'elatech asher sha'alt me'imo. Now I'll jump ahead for a second. They go home. I don't need
but
to jump ahead.
In modern Hebrew, doesn't it also mean to borrow?
Oh, we're going to get there in a second.
Sorry.
Not modern Hebrew and biblical Hebrew. We're going to get there in a moment.
Some Hebrew. Someplace.
Pasuk Yitchet. Vatomer. Timtza shivchatcha chem beinecha. So then she says, let your maidservant find favor in your eyes. not quite sure what the significance of having gone from being an Amma, or describing herself as an Amma, to describing herself as a Shivcha. And either way, it's a term of respect. Your servant, Yaakov says to Esav, Avdecha, right? Your servant, your maidservant. It's a way of describing. Ruth describes herself similarly to Boaz. Manochi kechad shivchatecha. It's a term of respect. Vatelech haisha ledarka. She goes home. Vatochau, she ate. Ufanea lo hayula od. She was no longer sad. On the contrary, she had her chance to make her request for a child. And on top of the request that she had,
he said she was
the Kohen Gadol said,
she got a bracha from the Kohen Gadol. Now, the Kohen Gadol has no clue what it is that she asked for. Unless there's more to this text, to this conversation, than it's described, she never tells him what her request is. And I really don't suspect she did tell him what the true nature of her request.
So how do we know what her request was?
We know it.
Yeah.
This isn't in Ba'eli.
Yeah.
Ba'eli did not write Sefer Shmuel.
Right. Yeah.
Shmuel wrote Sefer Shmuel. ותלך אישה לדרכה ותוכה ותלפניה לו היו לה עוד וישכימו בבוקר וישתחוו לפני השם. They'll get up in the morning, אלקנה, חנה, פנינה, they're ready to go home. וישובו ויבואו אל ביתה מרמטה וידע אלקנה את חנה אשתו ויזכרה השם. So in the routine of married life, suddenly there's an additional component there, which is ויזכרה השם. Remembered her. And memory in Tanakh is always a function, when it applies to God, is always a function of judgment. Another reason for the connection between this Haftorah and Rosh Hashanah. Zikaron, as it applies to God, is always a function of Mishpat. Not only as it applies to God, in Chumash, the word Lizkor is synonymous with Lishpot. Because you don't remember events just because you want to kind of record history. Memory has a judicial role to play. So we talk about Vashem zachar et Noach. God remembered Noach. Vayizkor Elokim et Noach. Vayetkol asher ito b'teva. God remembered Noach and all who were with him in the teva. It's this week's parasha. God didn't forget that he had Noach in the teva. Ki ein shichacha lifnei chisei chavodecha, we say in Rosh Hashanah. God never forgot that he had Noach on the table while he was bringing the marble. What is Vayizkor Elokim et Noach vet kol asher ito b'teva? Vayaver Elokim ruach al ha'aretz vayishoku amayim. God remembered Noach brought a wind that dried up the earth. Right? What does it mean? It means that he assessed at that moment whether Noach was worthy of survival. There was a mishpat that took place at that moment. It's one of the reasons why we quote the psukim about Noach in the tefillah on Rosh Hashanah, the tefillah of Zichronot. The tefillah of Zichronot on Rosh Hashanah is not about memory, it's about judgment. Yom HaZikaron is synonymous with Yom HaDin. Uvriot boi pakedu, v'ala medinot boi yamer, eza lachere, ve'eza lasova, ve'eza lava, ve'eza lashalom. There's a mishpat that's taking place on Rosh Hashanah. All of humankind, every nation, every creature. That's what zikaron means. Vayizkare Hashem, Hashem pakad et Sarah. He remembered Sarah. He assessed Sarah. He judged whether she was worthy to have a child. Vayizkare Hashem, he remembered her. Meaning, not that he forgot her. But that, on the contrary, Hashem sagarat rachma, beforehand he had closed the womb. Now he had opened the womb. Suddenly there was a mishpat that had taken place, and she emerged victorious. Yosef says to the sarha mashkim when he is told of the dreams, and he realizes that in 3 days' time the Sarmashkim is going to be returned to Paro's service. He says to him,
"Don't forget me."
Don't forget me. He says to him, "More than don't forget me." He says, "He's kartani el Paro, ki ganov gunavti me'eretz ha'ivrim v'gam po lo hasiti me'uma. What does v'hizkartani al paro mean? Remember me to Paro. Today we were saying, remember me to Paro, because I have been stolen from the land of the Ivrim, and here I have done nothing wrong. I don't think Yosef ever met Paro. Send him my regards. He's Katani El Paro. Remember me to Paro. Hey, send him my regards. Tell him hi. Right? What does Katani El Paro mean?
Have him judge.
Let him rejudge my case. Let him retry me. I am here innocently. I've done nothing wrong. So Lizkor to a Melech, and certainly to the Melech Machem Lachim, is a function of Mishpat. Vayizkare Hashem. A year later, she conceived and Vatele Ben. She had a child. She names this child. Vatikra et Shmo Shmuel.
Why is he called Shmuel? Ki Mehashem Sheiltiv.
It's a request.
Yes and no.
Because what was her request?
Give her a son.
Unetativ Lashem. Unetativ Lashem means?
She gave him back.
If you take something and then give him back, it means that you
borrowed it.
So, Ki Mehashem She'iltiv means from God she requested or from God she borrowed. Hence the pun on the phrase. What in the language of the Mefarshim they call Lashon Nofel Al Lashon. In English we would call it alliteration. Where
in Tanakh is full of it. This alliteration style, Lashon Nofel Al Lashon. It's everywhere. Because that's part of the play of the language of the Hebrew language. So on the one hand he's called Shaul Mehashem She'iltiv, requested of God or borrowed of God, because her request was in the Tativ Lashem. Now Eli has no clue to what her request is. But what was Eli's comment to her? Yitem Hashem et She'elatech Hashem Sha'alt. Request that you may, and she turns request into Ki Mehashem She'iltiv. Asked of him, requested of him, and we'll see later on, borrowed as well. Pasuk of Aleph, Vayal Ha'ish El Kana V'chol Beito Lizboch La'Hashem and Tzevach Hayamim Ve'et Nidro. A year later, El Kana and his household goes back to the Beit HaMikdash. V'chana lo alata. Chana said, no, this year I'm not going. Ki Amra Le'isha Ad Yigamel Hanar V'aviyoti V'vinireh V'nei Hashem. I need to wean my child. It's Adi Gamela. No, I'm nursing. I'm not making the travel to Shiloh while nursing. Traveling in any state in those days was not a safe, easy phenomenon. In a state of pregnancy or nursing was even worse. And that too goes back all the way. This I think we talked about in some other context, all the way back to the story of Rachel, whose journey from the house of Lavan was made while she was pregnant with Binyamin, and probably the reason she dies in childbirth. Right. But I will wait a year until I finish weaning him, then I will bring him. And we'll go to visit the face of God, meaning to go to the Beit HaMikdash. V'yashav Shem Ad Olam. This is the first time we hear what her intention is. Meaning, she made a promise. The promise is, you give me a child, I'll give him back to you. Right. How do you give him back to God?
Service to
him. You leave him in the Beit HaMikdash and let him grow up in the Beit HaMikdash. It's a very strange and unprecedented move. But that's what she says. Yashiv Sham Adolam. She will dwell. He will dwell there forever. What do you think Elkanah's response to that comment was? Okay, he says, I'll let you do that, but he suspects. What does he suspect? And he, remember, she's making an unprecedented, dramatic, and extraordinary promise that the child is a year old. It's too soon. I'll wait till he's two, and then I'll bring him back to the Beit HaMikdash, and then I'll leave him there forever.
And where the father has no role in any of this.
Besides the fact that he has no role,
he doesn't think he's going to follow through.
That I suspect he doesn't think she's going to follow through.
The older the child gets, the more attached. Yes.
That's right, and the harder it's going to be for her to live up to this promise. So Ve'omer la'el kana isha, kana her husband said to her. Give you an interesting exercise on your own. Go count how many times Elkanah is described as her husband. How many times it says Elkanah Isha?
This time.
Every reference to Elkanah. Yomal Elkanah Isha. Asiya tov be'inayich. If that's what you want to do, go ahead. Shviat gomlech oto, until you've weaned the child. However, achekem Hashem et dvaro. You keep your word to God. The child remained there till she finished weaning him. When she weaned him, she brought him up to the Beit HaMikdash with great sacrifices. Three oxes and kemach and yayin and flour and wine. She made a feast. Beit Hashem Shiloh. Behuna, child was a young boy, 2, 3, unclear how long she nursed him, but let's assume. Vayishchatu atapar, they slaughtered the ox, they made the sacrifices, vayivyu atanara el Eli, they brought the child to Eli. Now this is several years later. I don't expect Eli to have remembered this woman who he never met in the first place ever before. Right? She didn't know who she was. She has to remind him, my master, please, chay nafshecha Adoni, on your life, ani ha'isha hanitzevet imcha baze, litpalel el Hashem. Remember that woman who stood here and prayed? That was me. Elanara ze hitpalalti. This is the child I prayed for. Veiten Hashem li et she'elati asher sha'alti. Me'imo, Aiten Hashem li et she'elati asher sha'alti me'imo. That was exactly the phrase that Eli had used. Mm-hmm. Now Hannah uses it. God has given me the request that I have made of him. She reminds him of exactly that bracha. And v'gam anochi hishiltiu la'Hashem kol hayamim asher haya hu sha'ul la'Hashem v'yishtach hu sham la'Hashem v'hishiltiu la'Hashem kol yamei chayav hu sha'ul. I will. Hishiltiu lahashil is to lend. I will lend him to God all the days of his life. He is lent to God. Sha'ul Hashem. Sha'ul. So here's the pun. Sha'ul is to request. Sha'ul is also to borrow. And lahashil is to lend. So did she borrow him from God, or did she
loan him to
God?
Oh,
Kimei Hashem, Shaul. Why did she call him Shmuel? What was the name?
Because he was loaned to God.
She names him Shmuel, but to quote from Shmuel, Kimei Hashem Shiltiv.
Meshem Shi'iltiv, of God I requested. And to God he is lent.
That's different from borrowing and giving back.
Correct. Netativ Lashem Kleime Chayav. You give me a child, God, I will lend him back to you. He's mine. My child. Like every mother.
But she's lending him
to God by leaving him in the Mikdash to be raised by Eli and his surrogate or his stepbrothers, Chofni and Pinchas.
I thought they were his sons.
They were Eli's sons.
Yeah.
But those were his stepbrothers. Right.
Very strange setup.
Yeah.
Remarkably strange setup. So strange that it's unprecedented and no subsequent parallel to it. Unique in history. But the play on the words here, you know, the whole conversation revolves around this status of this child who is requested
and then
lent back to God. What is the purpose of lending him to God? What is the purpose of this mission? What is his role? How do you do that? How do you take a child and say, I'm going to lend him back to God?
It's the opposite of what we think, that our
right.
children are lent to
I
us.
I lend to us. Correct. It's the exact opposite of what we because we're looking at it from a perspective of almost existential perspective. Okay? Our lives are limited. We are here in borrowed time. She's not looking at it from an existential perspective. She's looking at it from a very concrete, tachlis, urgent perspective. This child is to be lent to God's service. How? By being apprenticed to Eli. Now, how do you put a Levi in the Beit HaMikdash and apprentice a Levi to the Kohen is a very strange thing to do. So maybe that's why on some level she figured, okay, she'll make him a Nazir. A Nazir is also has Kedusha. Nazir has similarities to a Kohen.
In this time, the Wabim didn't do any kind of service in the Beit Mikdash.
Did, but not in the context of a Kohen. I mean, there are Levim in the Beit Mikdash.
No, I'm talking about the times of the Mishkan. There wasn't any.
There were. The Levim, that's why they didn't have land, but not to be apprenticed to a Kohen, to be raised as a Kohen. We'll see later on, he's living in the Beit HaMikdash. According to many Mefarshim, he's actually sleeping in the Kodesh HaKadosh.
Strange.
The whole setup is
very unusual.
Remarkably
strange.
Unusual. Strange. The whole setup. That is the beginning. And then, to top it all off, she offers a Tila, which is stranger than anything we've ever seen. Right, so we talked a little bit about this. I think that's sort of where we got up to. We've gone through the tefillah, asked a lot of questions about the tefillah. We have about 5 minutes. We're not going to go through it now, but we'll take questions.
In this translation, the last sentence is, he then prostrated himself to Hashem. So is that
they? Vayishtach would be
plural.
Actually, it's plural. It's they. I would assume it's Eli and Chanor. Definitely plural.
So here it's not translated.
Really? And
here
it says he.
Really?
Says he. Yeah.
And
it says he.
Vayishtachu. Okay. Vayishtachu. Vayishtachavu. Maybe Vayishtachavu would be
plural.
Vayishtachu would be singular. Right. Now that would be referring to Eli. It's not every day that you get such a gift. An apprentice to the Kohen Gadol brought to you as a young child by a woman.
His guides would be Chofni and Pinchas. That's a...
Well, you know. Eli's relationship with Chofni and Pinchas is to be determined.
And here it's the footnote says either Elkanah or Shmuel.
Yeah.
3 years old. I don't think he's doing anything.
I think it's Shmuel, and I don't think it's Elkanah, because Elkanah's not in this conversation.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Well, that's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, I well, no, it's not a question of Archie. I assume that it's a function of the, that it's a discussion of the Mefarshim. That anytime you have a pronoun, which in this case the pronoun is built into the structure of the verb, but anytime you have a pronoun that is ambiguous, then the Mefarshim are going to weigh in on to whom it refers to. So to whom it refers could be any of the males in the story, Elkanah, Shmuel, or Eli. And if it was referring to Chana, it would say Vatishtachu, right? It would be in the plural, it would be in the feminine. Vatishtachu is certainly masculine, singular.
Many of them before him talk about whether or not Eli really wanted to take care of this child, or it was just He just said, okay, I got this job. Thank you very much.
My intuition is that he was tickled pink. I think he was thrilled.
Especially
given the challenges he had with his own children.
Second chance. Father never discussed this with her husband.
Nope.
He just accepted it.
But neither did Eshet Manoach discuss much with Manoach about what the destiny of Shimshon was to be.
Right,
it's part of the dynamic of the relationship between Shimshon and Shmuel is something we will have yet to discuss at length. But there's much to be said here. So next week, Bezat Hashem, we'll start from Tefillat Chana. Tefillat Chana is really a remarkable tefillah because after everything is said and done, she offers this tefillah that on the face of it seems to have nothing to do with anything. She talks about enemies, she talks about nations, she talks about war, she talks about battles, she talks about it's a remarkable tefillah, Hashem mimit mechaye morit sha'ov haya. So we will have to, I think we spend some time exploring this tefillah a little bit back in the spring. We'll review it again, and then we'll try to figure out what's going on with this child. What is the purpose of Shmuel? Why does Chana offer such a remarkable oath? From the very outset, her oath was defined. I mean, she had this in mind all along. It's clear that she had in mind that when this child is born, Netativ LaHashem Koyim Echayav, I will bring him back to God. Not just I will raise him to be a nice, good Jewish boy and keep mitzvos, give him to God's service. No, she meant it literally. I will bring him back to the Beit HaMikdash. I will give him to Eli, and he will be an apprentice to Eli in the Beit HaMikdash. Netativ LaHashem. That extraordinary offer is at the core, the center of this whole story, and that we need to understand.
Are you going to run parallel Monday and Wednesday?
He's got to figure that out.